studying him openly. What then? Come to the point. It's a gift I offer. Palpatine laughed without merriment. What could you possibly have to offer someone like me? Just this. She opened the soft shoulder bag to reveal a humanoid infant of less than a standard year in age. The infant's hairless head was stippled with an array of short but still pliant horns, and its entire body had been garishly and ceremonially tattooed in red and black pigments. A male Zabrak, Palpatine told himself, but not of the Iridonian sort. Rather a Dathomirian. How do you come by this newborn? Have you stolen him?
You misunderstand, good sir. My own child, this one is.
Palpatine glowered. You say that he is a gift, and yet you dissemble. Have you had dealings that have led you into such deep debt that you would part with your own flesh and blood? Or perhaps you're addicted to spice or some other intoxicant? She stiffened.
Neither. I seek only to save his life.
Palpatine's expression changed. Then speak honestly. You're a long way from your coven, Night Sister, and a practitioner of magics more than sufficient to keep your child from harm. Her eyes opened wide and bored into him, in search of explanation.
How?
Never mind how I know which, Palpatine said sharply. The child, whether yours or not, is a Night Brother, conceived for the purpose of serving the sisterhood as a warrior and slave. She refused to avert her gaze.
You're not a Jedi.
Clearly I am not, as I suspect you have already intuited. But you still haven't answered my question. Why are you trying to rid yourself of the infant?
To spare the one for the sake of the other, she said after a moment. Half a clan pair this one is, and I want one to live freely, since the other can't.
Who poses the threat?
Talzin is her name.
Who is Talzin?
The Night Sister Mother.
Palpatine filed the information away. Where is the infant's father?
Dead, by tradition,
he snorted. Will the infant not be missed?
Talzin knows only of the one, not the other.
You delude yourself. Gently, she pushed the shoulder bag toward him.
Then take him, please.
What would I do with him?
This one is strong in the Force. In the right hands, he can become a powerful asset.
Servitude of a different sort. She ignored the remark.
Take him. Save him.
Palpatine regarded the newborn again. Have you named him?
Maul, he is called.
Befitting the power you divine in him.
She nodded. Take him.
Palpatine gazed at her, and motioning with his right hand, said, You will forget this encounter. She locked eyes with him.
I will try.
For your own sake, I hope you do. Now go before I change my mind. Placing the bag in his hands, she turned and hurried off, disappearing into the crowd. Palpatine studied the bundle of life he held. That the Force was strong in the infant was reason enough not to allow him to wander about unprotected and perhaps fall into the hands of the Jedi. Now Palpatine simply had to figure out what to do with him. From a high turret in the old fort on Sojourn, Plagueis Insidious observed the revelry in the courtyard below. There, amid the blazing fires, the smell of fresh blood and roasting meat, the cacophony of guttural chants, strident music and screams of abandon, a gathering was in progress. Returned from the hunts, beings of many species told tall tales and shared in vulgar laughter, while exotic dancers writhed atop tables laden with food and intoxicating drinks. Away from the roasting pits, beings huddled in the sultry night air, forming alliances, revealing hidden agendas, hatching plots. Passion, envy, and conspiracy were on the loose. From the high turret, the two Sith could see Damask's sun guards and munes circulating. Larsh Hill introducing his eldest son, San, to representatives of the Commerce Guild and the Techno Union. The Gotal Grand Maj of the Order of the Canted Circle was speaking with Starship designer and Santhe Sinar CEO Naro Sinar. Boss Kabra was making the rounds as well, pressing the flesh, the scales, the rough hide of partners and potential allies. Members of the Trade Federation were in attendance, including a richly dressed Nymoidian, and for the first time in decades, representatives of various hive species were present. The Zycharian prelate, the Genosian archduke, even a couple of mistrustful and dangerous-looking insectoid colicoids from the colicoid creation nest.
"We will not be denied," Plagueis was saying with unusual annoyance. "We will have our way in the Senate, regardless of what the Grand Protectorate, Black Sun, and the rest wish to see happen. Let the beings of the Hydean Way and Rimmer Trade Route worlds go on thinking that the Trade Federation is seeking to tighten its grip on intersystem commerce. The real danger in seating the Federation's client worlds will emerge when the Senate ignores the needs of those worlds and disenfranchisement begins to spread through the mid and outer rims. Then the Republic will reap the whirlwind and we will harvest the benefits."
He exhaled in disgust.
"Pak's team and the rest aren't acting out of concern for the Republic, but out of fear that their entitlements might disappear if trade shifts to the outer systems. Half of them sit in the Rotunda only because I want them there. They've forgotten how effortlessly they can be replaced."
He swung away from the view of the courtyard to face Sidious.
"As for Varuna, you should encourage his plans to amass a space corps to defend Naboo against the Trade Federation. When we make him king, we will lead him by the nose into a morass that will appear to be of his own making."
Plagueis lowered his gaze to the courtyard.
"The climate begins to shift, Darth Sidious. The body politic begins to show signs of contagion. The reemergence of anger, hatred, and fear signal a loss of faith in the Force. The light is waning, pushed into retreat by dark matter, and the universe begins to seem inimical rather than comforting. In such times, beings are wont to look for solutions in the enactment of harsh laws, the ostracism of strangers and warfare. Once the Republic has fallen, the Jedi are but a memory, and beings have nowhere to turn but to us. We will provide them with a sense of stability and order. A list of enemies, weapons capable of decimating entire star systems, jurisdictional prisons in which they can feel secure."
He gestured to the courtyard.
"Look how they hunger for the dark."
A fierce light came into Plagueis' eyes.
"We must demand the attention of the dark side to aid us in dictating the future. Together and separately, we will see to that. And once we've put these Senate issues behind us, we will set the stage for the next act. With the promise of unlimited funding, guilds and unions will ally, and the hive species will turn pincer and claw to the manufacture of weapons, even in the absence of conflict, let alone all-out war."
Doubt tugged at the corners of Sidious's mouth.
"The Jedi won't simply stand by and do nothing, Master. While I have no affection for them, I do respect their power, and weakening the Republic without weakening the Jedi could provide them with justification for attempting a coup. They have the numbers to succeed."
Plagueis took it under advisement.
"Their time is coming, Sidious. The signs are in the air. Their order might have already been decimated had it not been for the setback Darth Gravid dealt the Sith. But his apprentice carried the imperative forward, and each successive Sith Lord improved on it, Tenebris and his master most of all, though they wasted years attempting to create a targeted virus that could be deployed against the Jedi, separating them from the Force, as if there were some organic difference between the practitioners of the light and dark sides. As if we communicate with the dark side through a different species of cellular intermediaries, when in fact we are animated by the same power that drives the passions of these beings gathered below. Target midichlorians, and we target life itself.
An attack of that sort would fail regardless, Sidious said, as if thinking out loud. The Jedi are widely scattered, and it's unlikely that we would be able to act quickly enough to kill all of them in the same instant. We would need to assign an individual assassin to each, and there would be no way to still the tongues of that many assassins. Our plan would be revealed. We would be betrayed and become the targeted ones.
Plagueis paced away from the turret's window, his hands interlocked behind his back. We don't want them to die too quickly in any case. Not, that is, until the Republic has been so ravaged, so weakened, that beings will willingly embrace the stability we impose.
Are the weapons that will be produced by the Kallikoids and the others meant ultimately to be used against the Jedi?
We shall see what comes to pass. Until such time, we must accept the fact that no mere army can overwhelm the Jedi. The ancient Sith were tens of thousands strong and failed the test. Once the galaxy teemed with warriors and warships. Now we have only isolated bands of mercenaries and star system defense forces. That's why we must strive to return the galaxy to a state where barbarism is the norm.
The Jedi will have to be felled from within, Sidious said, his eyes tracking Plagueis as the Mune paced the floor. Lured into a trap of their own devising, as you said we will do with Varuna.
Plagueis stopped to regard him. Follow that thought. Sidious took a moment.
We will have to exploit their vanity and blind obedience to the Republic, he said with greater confidence, and as if the truth of it should be obvious. They must be made to appear the enemies of peace and justice, rather than the guardians.
The enemies of peace and justice, rather than the guardians, Plagueis repeated in revelation. Even the survivors of a purge would be forced into hiding. Coming back to himself, he cut his gaze to Sidious. Great care has to be taken not to turn them into martyrs, Darth Sidious. If, in the end, we want the beings of the galaxy to turn their backs to the light side of the Force.
Forceful beings will continue to be born.
In the absence of training and brainwashing, they will pose no harm to us. You will see to that, Supreme Chancellor Palpatine.
Sidious looked at the floor and shook his head. You should be the one, Master.
No, Plagueis said firmly. It must be you. You have the political skills, and more to the point, you are a human. In this era, only a human is capable of rising to the top of Coruscant's biased political heap.
Human or not, my knowledge of the dark side will never equal yours. The title, the crown, should be yours.
And it will be, once you openly appoint me co-chancellor. Feared and respected by the galaxy's most powerful beings, Higo Damask will be seen as a windfall for the Republic. But even then, I will advise only in secret from behind your throne.
Sidious bowed his head in deference. In the annals of Sith history, you will be known as Plagueis the Wise.
Plagueis quirked a cunning smile. You flatter me.
Whatever you ask of me, Master, I will do it.
Plagueis fell silent for a long moment, then said, You need now to hear about the first mission I performed for Darth Tenebris. The events transpired some 25 years into my apprenticeship. At the time, Tenebris had sought to expand his network of influential beings by reaching out to a human industrialist named Carid Santhe.
The former owner of Santhe Corporation.
The same, Plagueis said. Santhe Corporation had been designing freight vessels for generations, but had only limited success with its line of personal starships. My master believed that he might entice Carid into an alliance by offering him exclusive rights to a Rugis gnome ship. Santhe leapt at the opportunity, but only to manipulate Tenebris into a situation where agents of Santhe Security were able to steal the plans.
Plagueis paused in narrow-eyed reflection. It was one of the few times I saw my master outmaneuvered. But he didn't set his sights on revenge. Not immediately, at any rate. Once in production, the starship met with such success that Kered Sante was able to acquire a controlling interest in Sinar Technologies and Republic Sinar Systems. Only by agreeing to an arranged marriage between his youngest daughter was Sinar's president, Naro, able to retain his position as chief designer. By then, though, Naro had entered into a secret partnership with Tenebris, and the time had come to settle scores. Plagueis moved as he spoke. Damask Holdings was in its infancy, but I had already earned a reputation among the galaxy's elite, and so received an invitation to attend a design conference on Coralag, which was then headquarters not only for Sinar Technologies, but for Aether Hypernautics, Dante Artifice, and a dozen other corporations. The guest speaker was the senator representing the Bormia sector, and many luminaries from Coruscant, Corellia, and Kuat attended. From distant Liana came Kered Sante and his young and unhappy wife, supported by an entourage of retainers and Sante security guards. I was seated at a table directly across from him, and the menu specialty that night was bloat eel. Have you ever tasted it, Sidious? As a teenager, at a gala hosted by House Palpatine. Then you know that the creature is one of the most poisonous to be found in the galaxy. The preparation is both dangerous and exacting, as the creature must be skinned while alive to guard against its toxins infiltrating the flesh. Needless to say, nothing enlivens a banquet like the prospect of near-instant death, and the hall could barely contain the anticipation as individual portions were served. I waited to act until I saw Sante chewing his first bite. Plagueis brought the thumb and forefinger of his left hand close together, and Sidious, taken by surprise, felt his throat close. He gasped for breath.
Yes. Just so you have an understanding of what Sante must have felt.
Plagueis opened his fingers, and Sidious inhaled deeply, his face flushed, and his hands stroking his throat.
Only then I kept the pressure on until his face began to turn red. His hands flew to his throat. His muted calls for help brought everyone around him out of their chairs. I think his bulging eyes might have found mine when I finally pinched his trachea closed completely. Of course, medtechs had been standing by in the event of just such an emergency. Ithorians, if I recall correctly, armed with doses of antitoxin and medicines to counter the effects of anaphylactic shock. But none did the trick that night, for the dark side of the Force had Sante in its grip, and no drug or resuscitation technique was equal to the task of keeping him alive.
Plagueis touched his chin. Many alleged that Rugis Nome and Naro Sinar had somehow engineered an assassination. Others that Malkite poisoners or a sect of Geno Harridan had been contracted to carry out the kill. But in the end, the chefs were held accountable and given long prison sentences. Sante security squads made several attempts on my master's life afterward, but we dealt with them. Much later we learned that Sante's body had been placed in carbonite freeze, and that all his internal organs had been replaced by vat-grown ones. The surgical teams may even have been successful at restarting his body, but the Kered Sante they had known was irretrievable. Plagueis said nothing for a long moment, then continued.
The circumstances will be different for you. You won't have the satisfaction of seeing our opponent die in person, because we want to ensure your deniability. A public assassination on Coruscant would be best for sending a message.
Senator Pak's team, Sidious said in a raspy voice, tinged with residual anger.
Plagueis shook his head.
Team may yet prove useful.
I'm referring to Senator Vidar Kim. His sentiments have made him a liability. More important, his death will allow us to position you where you've long yearned to be.
Chapter 16, Bold as Love. The hood of his stylish robe raised against a chill wind, Palpatine hurried through the streets of Theed. The sudden turn in the weather abetted his desire to avoid making eye contact with strangers, or worse, encountering anyone he knew. As he grew stronger in the dark side, the profane world became a stranger and stranger place, swept by currents he'd had no previous awareness of, and populated by vaguely outlined life forms he saw as magnitudes of the Force. As Plagueis ordered, he had been living in the future, consorting with the dark side to execute the plans he and his master had designed. Vidar Kim's office was in the eastern portion of the city, a long walk from the apartment Palpatine had been renting for the past several years, and the quickest route required crossing and recrossing the Saliu tributaries that define Theed's districts and neighborhoods. He had never had much fondness for the city, with its ancient buildings, public squares, its tens of thousands of residents going about their lives, and now Theed began to seem like some stage set in an elaborate theater production, and Naboo itself a node in a vast web being woven by the dark side, into which so many planets and species would ultimately be drawn. At no time during the visit to Sojourn had Darth Plagueis asked to hear his feelings about the death order he had issued for Vidar Kim. And no wonder, since Palpatine had given his word to do anything Plagueis asked of him. But it was obvious that the Mune had sensed Palpatine's conflict. Fear and hatred had prompted him to murder his family in cold blood. But his relationship with Kim was as close as he had come to having a true friendship. Even though, as Naboo's senator, Kim stood between Palpatine and his immediate goal. On Sojourn, Plagueis' parting words to him were, "Remember why the Sith are more powerful than the Jedi, Sidious. Because we are not afraid to feel. We embrace the spectrum of emotions, from the heights of transcendent joy to the depths of hatred and despair. Fearless, we welcome whatever paths the dark side sets us on, and whatever destiny it lays out for us." Clearly, Plagueis knew that Palpatine had helped seal Kim's fate by encouraging him to take a stand against the Trade Federation, and therefore against Plagueis. That his master hadn't said as much was perhaps his way of reminding Palpatine that he would have to be prepared to accept any and all consequences that sprang from his machinations. It was a subtle lesson, but one Palpatine took to heart. From then on, he would be careful to plan his moves meticulously, and more important, to allow the dark side to complete its lapidary work of transforming him into a powerful being. Recalling Plagueis' surprise Force choke, he pledged also never again to lower his guard. But he viewed the lesson as part of the process of their learning to rely on each other and forge themselves into a team. United in the dark side, they could keep no secrets. There could be no chance of one being able to act without the other being aware. They had to learn to see through each other. Palpatine hadn't been attempting to flatter Plagueis when he had called him wise. Not entirely, at any rate. The Mune was powerful beyond Palpatine's present understanding, the only being capable of guiding the galaxy into the future, a crescendo. At times, it was difficult to grasp that they would see in their lifetime the fall of the Republic and the annihilation of the Jedi Order, and yet Palpatine seemed to know it to be true. A grand design was unfolding, in which he wasn't merely a player, but an architect.
Resigning himself to Kim's death was easier than it might have been because Kim, too, had become a broken man in the wake of the deaths of his wife and younger sons. His reaching out to the son he had voluntarily surrendered to the Jedi was an act of desperation, and based on nothing more than a desire to assure that the Kim family line continued. How like the self-important royals among whom Palpatine had been raised, so fervent to be remembered by those who followed. Rather than demand or ensure that Palpatine got his hands dirty once more, Plagueis had insisted on providing him with an agent to facilitate the assassination. Plagueis had said that they needed to guarantee Palpatine's deniability and make certain that no hint of scandal pursue him. But Palpatine had begun to wonder. Despite all the talks about partnership and disclosures, had Plagueis merely been making excuses for the fact that he harbored doubts about Palpatine's abilities? Palpatine thought back to the story Plagueis had recounted about the murder of Kerid Santhi. Blame had fallen on the chefs who had prepared the bloat eel. Kim's death, however, wouldn't result from food poisoning, but public assassination. So who might emerge as having the most to gain from his death? Certainly not the Naboo or the Grand Protectorate. The fact that fingers would point instead to the Trade Federation made him wonder why Plagueis would want to place the cartel in a position that jeopardized its chances of seating new worlds in the Senate. So once more he found himself wondering, did Plagueis have an ulterior motive for not wanting the Trade Federation to succeed? He wanted Kim's death to be viewed as a message. But by whom? Perhaps Palpatine was meant to be the recipient. When Plagueis said that many of the senators were expendable, that they retained their seats only because of him, was he, in the same breath, saying that Palpatine, even as Sidious, was also expendable, easily replaced by another forceful apprentice? While the Mune encouraged transparency in Palpatine, he sometimes made himself opaque. Would he, at some point, bequeath all his knowledge to his apprentice? Or would he hold back, merely to keep the upper hand?
Thank you for coming on such short notice, Palpatine, Kim said in a rush, ushering him into an office cluttered with data disks and flimsy printouts, and smelling of sweat, stale air, spoiling food. Tall windows opposite the hardwood entry doors overlooked the palace, including the new tower that Tapelo, in accordance with tradition, had constructed on being elected monarch. What I have to say will place you at some risk, but there's no one I trust more than you. Kim was in constant motion while he spoke, moving from his desk to the windows and back again. I'm not entirely sure that this office is secure, but we have to take the chance. Palpatine concealed a frown of misgiving and gestured to the couch. Please, Vidar, sit and unburden yourself. Kim came to a halt, exhaled wearily, and did as Palpatine suggested. His face was drawn, his hair in disarray, his normally neat beard and mustache in need of grooming. Palpatine, I have good reason to suspect that Tapelo and Varuna arranged the crash that claimed the lives of my family. Palpatine's surprise was sincere. Vidar, the crash was investigated and ruled an accident. Some problem with the anti-grav... Accidents can be faked, planned. You've piloted speeders ever since I've known you. You know that systems can be sabotaged. Palpatine sat down opposite him. What possible motive would they have for killing your family? Kim's bloodshot eyes fixed on him. I know their dirty secrets, Palpatine. I know about the payments they've been receiving from the Trade Federation since Tapelo took office, the laws they've enacted to open all of Naboo to survey and plasma exploitation. I know about the deals they struck with certain members of the electorate to engineer Tapelo's unprecedented victory in the last election. Even so, Palpatine said after a moment, why would they bring your family into this? Kim all but growled. By relieving me of my plenary duties, they risk angering many of the royals who support me. Instead, they hope to persuade me to tender a resignation out of grief, out of fear, out of I don't know what.
Tapelo would know better than to attempt such a despicable act.
You give him too much credit. The crash was meant to be a message to me, but it had the opposite effect.
How so? Palpatine said, leaning toward him.
I'm leaving for Coruscant this afternoon, and my first act will be to notify the Jedi Order.
Palpatine sat up straight.
Vidar, the Jedi listen only to the Senate and the Supreme Chancellor. You can't simply walk into the temple. I'll contact the members of the Council through my son. If I can convince Ranha to leave the Order, the information will be my gift to the Jedi.
And suppose Ranha doesn't want any part of this? Palpatine crossed his arms across his chest. Have you ever been able to speak with him? It's my understanding that Jedi aren't permitted contact with their parents. Kim scowled and studied the carpet.
Regardless, I was able to make contact.
And? Kim's expression was cheerless when he looked up.
He told me that I'm a stranger to him, and that the Kim name has no significance for him.
Palpatine sighed. Then, that's the end of it.
No, he has agreed to speak with me in person on Coruscant. I'm determined to convince him, Palpatine. Family must come first.
Palpatine bit back what he was about to say, and began again. Will you promise to keep me informed, or at least let me know how to reach you? Kim went to the desk and sorted through the mess until he found the flimsy he was looking for.
This is my itinerary for the coming week, he said, passing the flimsy to Palpatine. Palpatine, if something untoward should happen to me on Coruscant...
Stop, Vidar. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. Kim ran a hand over his head.
You're right.
He returned to the couch and sat.
Palpatine, we're too close in age for me to have thought of you as a son. But I do consider you the younger brother I never had.
Palpatine nodded without a word.
If I fail to get through to Ranha or the Jedi, I can at least alert my colleagues on the Senate Investigatory Committee.
Palpatine restrained an impulse to stand.
I think you're wrong about Tapelo and Varuna, Vidar, but I can say without hesitation that you will be risking your life by making such accusations public. I'm perfectly aware of that, Palpatine. But if Ranha rejects my plea, what else will I have to live for?
Palpatine placed his hand on Kim's shoulder. The small part you will play in the revenge of the Sith. By the time he left Kim's office, the weather had turned sharply colder. Snow flurries were swirling around the palace towers, and the shallows to the Soliu tributaries were sheened with ice. The agent from Coruscant whom Plagueis had provided, Sate Pestage, was waiting in a small plaza behind the Parnelli Art Museum, warming his hands with his breath.
The Naboo have never heard of climate control, he commented as Palpatine approached.
Recalling his early conditioning sessions on Glacial Mygeto, Palpatine almost laughed at the man's remarks. Instead, he said, radical change has always come slowly to this world. Pestage cast a glance at the stately columns that enclosed the domed museum.
No doubt about that.
Slightly taller and older than Palpatine, he was sinewy and capable-looking. His brown eyes were close-set and glistening, and his pointed nose and angular cheekbones were emphasized by black hair that had receded from his forehead and temple. Plagueis had mentioned that Pestage had been born in Diplona, on Siutric IV, an industrialized ecumenopolis outside of which Darths Bane and Zanna had once lived secret lives. Plagueis hadn't revealed how he had discovered Pestage. Perhaps Damask Holdings had had dealings with Pestage's influential and extensive family. But he had said
that Pestage was someone Palpatine might want to consider adding to his growing entourage of aides and confidants. From the pocket of his robe, Palpatine prized the flimsy Vidarkim had given him and handed it over.
His itinerary for Coruscant.
Perfect.
Pestage slipped the flimsy into his pocket.
I want you to wait until his business on Coruscant is concluded.
Whatever you say.
He's threatening to alert the Jedi Order and the Senate Investigatory Committee about various deals that were made.
Pestage snorted.
Then he deserves everything that's coming to him.
He scanned their surroundings without moving his head.
Have you made a decision about who to use from the data I supplied?
The Maladians, Palpatine said.
A group of highly trained humanoid assassins. They had struck him as the obvious choice. Pestage nodded.
Can I ask why?
Palpatine wasn't accustomed to having to justify his decisions, but answered regardless.
The Mandalorian Death Watch has its own problems, and the Bando Gora its own galactic agenda.
I couldn't agree more, Pestage said. Besides, the Maladians are known to honor all their contracts.
How soon can you have them on Coruscant?
Pestage looked at him askance.
Perhaps it's best that remains on a need-to-know basis.
The man's audacity both impressed and bridled Palpatine.
There can be no mistake, Sate.
A long-suffering look flared on Pestage's face, but his tone was compliant when he responded.
If there are, then I'm certain this will be our final conversation. I know fully well what Magister Damask and you are capable of, and I hope to make myself worthy of continuing to serve you. One day, perhaps, you'll begin to think of me as family, as I'm sure Senator Kim does you.
Just how much does this man know? Palpatine wondered.
You've no qualms about living a double life, Sate?
Some of us are simply born into it, Pestage said, indifferent to Palpatine's penetrating gaze.
You'll contact me here?
As soon as the work is completed, just make sure to stay close to your calm.
You'll also be contacting Magister Damask?
Pestage rocked his head.
He gave me the impression that he would be unavailable for the next few weeks. But I suspect we're safe in assuming that the results won't escape his notice.
On a planet at the edge of known space, above the hollow well of a gleaming metallic table, a quarter-sized, three-dimensional image of a tall biped rotated between graphs and scrolling lines of anatomical and physiological data. In a spoon-like seat, suspended from the White Room's towering ceiling, sat Higo Damask, dwarfed by a trio of slender-tailed scientists, two crested males, and a female whose complexion was more gray than white.
This being is representative of the entire species?
The scientist called Nee Timor asked in a gentle, almost susurrant voice.
This one murdered 6 members of his species, Damask said. But he is otherwise typical of the Yinchori.
Tenebris had introduced him to the planet Kamino early on in his apprenticeship, but he hadn't visited in more than 3 years. In stalking Sojourn's Greel forests with rare and in some cases extinct fauna, he had hired the Kaminoans to grow clones from biological samples he procured through brokers of genetic materials. The glassy eyes, long necks, and sleek bodies of the bipedal indigenes spoke to a marine past, though in fact they had been land dwellers for millions of years preceding a great flood that had inundated Kamino. With global catastrophe looming, most technologically advanced sentient species would have abandoned their homeworld and reached for the stars. But the Kaminoans had instead constructed massive stilt cities that were completed even while the oceans of their world were rising and submerging the continents. They had also turned their considerable intellect to the science of cloning as a means of ensuring the survival of their species, and along the way had taken genetic replication farther than any known species in the galaxy.
Residing outside the galactic rim, the Kaminoans performed their work in secret and only for the very wealthy. It was unlikely, in any case, that they would have abided by the Republic's restrictions on cloning. Moral principles regarding natural selection seemed to be something they had left on the floor of what was now Kamino's planet-wide ocean, which perhaps explained why they were no more reluctant about providing game animals for sojourn than they were about supplying shovel-handed clones to work in the mines of inhospitable Subterral. Damask considered them to be one of the galaxy's most progressive species, almost Sith-like in their emotional aloofness and scientific objectivity. The female scientist, Kosai, had highlighted an area of the Yenchori's midbrain.
The lack of neural pathways to the forebrain indicates an innate proclivity for violence, although the absence could be idiosyncratic.
The third Kaminoan, Laknor, called for an enhancement of the highlighted area.
The Yenchori's violent nature could complicate matters, Magister. Without access to sociological studies, we have no means of determining to what degree the culture of violence shapes the beings born into it. A clone raised in a laboratory setting might exhibit feral behavior unless provided with some means to express aggression.
An outlet, Kosai offered.
Scientific studies are available, Damask said. The question is, can compliance be bred into them without affecting their violent tendencies?
Probably not without disturbing the basic personality matrix, Kosai said. We might produce a clone that is merely Yenchori in aspect, but lacks the signature characteristics of the species.
Damask frowned. That won't do.
Have you considered using a more acquiescent species? Ni-Timor asked.
Which would you recommend?
One of the placid species. Dithorians, for example, or Ka'amasi?
Damask shook his head. Neither species would suit my purposes. What about humans?
Our experience with humans is limited, though of course we have grown many replacement organs. Human emotionalism is somewhat problematic, Kosai said, but not unsolvable.
Damask considered the comment, and then agreed with the Kaminoan's assessment. Emotion in human beings was a fatal flaw, the same characteristic that fueled their need to form strong bonds and believe that all life was sacred, made them compassionate to a fault. Only weeks earlier, on Sojourn, he realized that even Sidious, for all his growing strength in the dark side, remained a prisoner of his emotions. That Sidious was feeling an urge to stretch out with his new powers was to be expected and encouraged, but he had to be taught the lesson every Sith needed to learn. With great subtlety, Sidious had manipulated Vidar Kim into a position where he had become a liability and therefore had to die. He hadn't bothered to address the issue directly, because the time had come for Sidious to embark on the political career that would carry him to the chancellorship. Still, Sidious's reaction to the assassination orders, fleeting as it had been, had convinced Plagueis of the need for additional tests. Sidious didn't need to have his mistakes explained to him. He needed to experience the consequences.
Perhaps, Magister, Laknor was saying, if we understood your plans for the Yenchori clones.
I would expect them to serve as soldiers.
Ah, Ni-Timor said. Then obedience, not mere compliance, must be a prime consideration. And yet the need for some measure of free will, Kosai was quick to point out. Or else why not simply use combat automata?
Laknor's large eyes fixed on Damask.
These Yenchori appear to be ready-made for war, Magister. Are there so few of them in the galaxy that you need to clone an army?
He had deliberately avoided mentioning Yenchori immunity to force suggestion because he should have no way of knowing about that, or indeed anything about the actions of midichlorians. But it was precisely the reptilian's capability to fashion force bubbles
that he hoped to explore.
As you've already pointed out, he said after a moment, their innate bellicosity interferes with their ability to follow orders.
Mostly to himself, Ni-Timor said,
we would need to assure that their violent tendencies remained intact while their behavior was less willful.
Yes, Damask said.
Kosai craned her long neck.
Very challenging, though perhaps if we could be supplied with a template for experimentation.
She gestured toward the 3D images.
Is this specimen available for thorough evaluation?
I could have him delivered to Kamino, Damask said. Assuming for the moment that you can discover some way to provide me with what I need, how much time would be required to grow a mature clone?
The three scientists traded looks.
In the case of the Inchori, Ni-Timor said at last, certainly no fewer than 12 standard years to allow for both physical and mental development. As you know, we have had some success in accelerating the growth rate of certain cloned creatures, but not yet with full sentience, owing to the plasticity of the youthful brain.
More important, Lacnor said, while we might be able to grow a few clones, our facilities are at present inadequate to produce an army of any size.
We would also need to consult with military specialists regarding programming, Kosai added.
That can all be arranged, Damask said. Would you have any objections to working with Rotana Heavy Engineering?
Of course not, Ni-Timor said.
Then Damask Holdings can provide whatever funding you need. Kosai's eyes appeared to widen.
The Prime Minister will be very pleased to learn of this,
she said, with what passed for animation on Kamino.
In his apartment in Snowbound Feed, Palpatine watched a holonet replay of Jedi Knight Ranhar Kim leaping from a Coruscant taxi in mid-flight onto a monospeeder piloted by the Maladian contracted to assassinate the Elder Kim. At the same time, Palpatine spoke by comlink with Sate Pestage.
Is Naboo threading the story? Pestage asked.
On every network. Breaking news, Coruscant,
a female correspondent was saying.
Chamo Sector Senator Bida Kim of Naboo was killed earlier today while en route to Mezzaline Spaceport in what appears to have been an assassination. A Havacam stationed at Node SSJ in the Sak District captured the moment when a monospeeder approached Senator Kim's taxi from behind and its helmeted pilot unleashed a salvo of blaster bolts, killing Kim instantly and barely missing a second passenger, an as yet unidentified Jedi Knight. The Havacam recording shows the human male Jedi, armed with an activated lightsaber, hurling himself from the taxi and knocking the pilot assassin from the seat of the monospeeder. Eyewitnesses state that the Jedi managed to steer the assailant to a pedestrian walkway close to where the speeder crashed and burned, but real-time news has yet to learn whether the assassin survived the fall. Wounded in the attack, the pilot of the taxi was taken to Sak Med Center, where his condition is listed as grave. Is the Maladian alive?
Palpatine demanded of Pestage.
No. She spiked herself with a neurotoxin while Ranhar was trying to force information from her.
You're certain?
Absolutely certain.
The fool, Palpatine fumed.
Why didn't she wait until Kim had exited the taxi at Mezzaline?
You instructed me to make it public, which is exactly what I told her. She made a point of firing in full view of the security cam, but I haven't been able to determine whether or not she knew that Kim was riding with a Jedi. Based on the placement of the blaster bolts, I think she planned on taking out both of them.
And if she'd succeeded, the Jedi would be conducting their own investigation.
They are regardless, Pestage said. Because Ranhar issued a statement to the media that he may have been the target.
Palpatine directed a scowl at the comlink cam.
Why didn't you warn her about Ranhar?
I did warn her. Maybe she wanted to add another Jedi kill to her resume. Another? As I told you, the Maladians are very good at what they do.
Palpatine considered it. If Ranha is under the impression that he might have been the target, then Kim may not have revealed his suspicions about Tapelo and Varuna.
He didn't. I had him under surveillance from the moment he arrived on Coruscant, and he didn't go anywhere near the Jedi Temple or meet with anyone on the Senate Investigatory Committee. I have recordings of the three meetings he had with Ranha in his office in the Senate Annex, and at no time did he offer anything more than veiled references to intrigues on Naboo.
Was he able to persuade Ranha to leave the Order?
No. Ranha said that he respected Kim for being his... what was the word he used? Progenitor. But that he considers the temple to be his home and the Jedi to be his family.
Palpatine forced an exhale.
I warned him.
Kim tried to convince him that family blood comes first, but Ranha might as well have been listening to an episode of Coruscant Confessions.
Magister Damask will not be pleased. What rumors are circulating in the Senate?
That Kim may have been involved in shady business, that he double-crossed a group of lobbyists. You've got the Senate worried, if that was the idea.
Plagueis would be satisfied to learn as much, Palpatine thought. The message, he now realized, had been directed not to anyone in particular, but to the Senate itself. Beyond the goal of advancing Palpatine's political career ahead of schedule, the murder of Kim had spread apprehension in the galactic capital.
It's done. In any case, he said finally.
And without any leads for the police or the Jedi to pursue, you're completely in the clear.
Palpatine relaxed somewhat.
You've done well, Sate. The close call notwithstanding. There's a place for you among my support group if you're interested.
Pestage Two sounded relieved.
Then I suppose I'll be seeing you on Coruscant, Senator Palpatine.
Chapter 17. Days of Wine and Impropriety. Supreme Chancellor Thoris Darris was largely responsible for the heady atmosphere that prevailed on Coruscant. A human native of Coralog, Darris had brought a sense of style to the galactic capital that had been absent a decade earlier when Vela Pessivus held the position and hadn't really been seen since the era of Ixis Valorum. Darris was unmarried, an incorrigible womanizer, an enthusiast of sport, opera, legitimate gambling, and high cuisine. His first term of office was characterized by a marked upswing in intemperance and, in the end, rampant corruption. Following the example set by the Supreme Chancellor, many of the tens of thousands who served in the Senate or lobbied on behalf of autocratic corporations and cartels had transformed Coruscant into a den of self-indulgence unrivaled anywhere in the core or inner rim. From all areas of the galaxy had come beings eager to attend to the needs of the new political elite, from chefs to artists to specialists in pleasure. Courtesy of the Trade Federation and its numerous affiliates and corporate partners, goods flooded in from thousands of worlds, giving rise to new fashions, new foods, and novel forms of extravagance. Privileged Coruscanti, determined to enjoy life at the center, turned a blind eye to the storms that were brewing on the edges of civilization. Intersystem rivalries, piratism, organized crime, and spiraling their way toward the core. In 3 years, the planet saw more immigration than it had seen in the preceding 100, primarily from the Outer Rim, whose non-humanoid species arrived in complete ignorance of the hardships that awaited them. For Palpatine, Coruscant exceeded his expectations. 5 years of travel and adventuring in the expansion region and colonies had given him a taste for the high life, and here was a place not simply where his darkest desires could be fulfilled, but also where he could put his unique talents to the test. Its topography of cloud-cutting edifices was a microcosm of the galaxy, swarming with beings who were willing to do whatever was necessary to claw their way from the depths, overseen by a tiered elite that nursed on their misery. If Coruscant was a magnet for those without skills or promise, it was also a paradise for those with credits and connections. And with assistance from many of the scions of wealth Palpatine had met while serving as Naboo's ambassador, along with Higo Damask's coterie of cronies and minions, he felt that he was on his way to the summit of the Senate podium from the moment his boots touched the unnatural ground. He grasped immediately that the only way the Republic might have saved itself was by removing the Senate to a world where temptation wasn't lurking at every traffic nexus, opportunity in every balconied cafe, vice in every canyon. Although the racket that Supreme Chancellor Darris and the Senate had going was obvious only if one knew where to look, and that frequently required having unrestricted access to the private clubs and back rooms to which bribes gravitated. Even without the Force, Palpatine knew he would have succeeded. The task would prove no more challenging than gaining the full confidence of his peers. With everyone striving to outdo one another, he need only ensure that he dress well, dine in the right places, associate with the proper company, and renew his season passes to the galaxy's opera. At the same time, he understood that he could be almost as anonymous as he wished, simply by venturing up or down, dressing up or down, mingling with merchants rather than politicians, or consorting with the hucksters, shysters, con and scam artists that populated the lower levels. His first apartment wasn't luxurious, but it was located in the government district, with room enough for his growing art collection, which now included a costly neranium and bronzium sculpture of the ancient sage Sistros, appropriate for the affluent head of House Palpatine, and containing his original hand-built lightsaber, concealed in a cylindrical cavity undetectable by security scans. The fact that his first official duty as Naboo's interim senator was to attend a funeral, his second that year, seemed only appropriate, given the Sith's eventual plans for Coruscant. Orders to attend Vidar Kim's funeral had come both from Naboo and from Plagueis, who said that he should use the opportunity to seek out Ranhar Kim and speak with him personally. Palpatine had yet to meet one-on-one with the Jedi, and a conversation with Ranhar would allow him to test his ability to conceal his true nature from another Force user. "As wicked as Coruscant is," Plagueis had told him, "the Force is strong there because of the presence of so many Jedi. If you are successful in hiding in plain sight, you will be able to conceal your nature even from the most powerful among them. Take Ranhar into your confidence, and once you have, spend some of your time on Coruscant, acquainting yourself with the spired headquarters of our enemy, and ask yourself, is this not a fortress designed to hold the dark at bay?" Otherwise, Plagueis' silence on the matter of Kim's assassination had been deafening. On learning that King Tapolo had appointed Palpatine interim senator, Plagueis offered his congratulations, but nothing more. After months of not seeing him, Palpatine had hoped to find Plagueis waiting for him on Coruscant, but Higo Damask and the Munes, who made up Damask Holdings, were conducting unspecified business on distant Serrano. The funeral service was held at Naboo's embassy, which was located below and to the west of Monument Plaza and the Senate. Dressed in a high-collared cape and purple robes, Palpatine arrived at the ornate monad in the company of Kenman Doriana, Sate Pestage, and Janus Grigiatus, who had been dispatched to Coruscant by Tapolo, and whom Palpatine suspected had some strength in the Force. Kenman and Sate had forged an instant bond. The youthful Doriana was made for a world like Coruscant, and he couldn't have asked for a better guide to the galactic capital's titillating underbelly than Pestage, who seemed to know every nook and cranny of the place. Ranhar Kim was among several dozen guests who were attending the service. Palpatine waited until the Jedi was alone in the viewing room before approaching him.
In concealing yourself, you will not be able to rely on your dark gifts, Plagueis said. Instead, you must be yourself, submerged in the unified pattern to which the Jedi are attuned, visible in the Force, but not as a Sith. Since you can